Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more.
After you, Scott, you're live.
Okay. We're live. Oh no.
Well, you're recording.
You never know what Sunny's actually gonna keep. And so I wore a semi-skin colored shirt again. Just to make sure she's not sharing too much. Because she gave me a lot of shit for it the other day. All right. Now you can actually see me, maybe.
That's because we got into recording. Everyone was like, Scott, you're not wearing a top.
It was a skin colored shirt. Okay, so anyway, welcome to the Publishing Rodeo, where we say the quiet part out loud. We have agent and author extraordinaire Christina Perez. Did I say that right? I'm so sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly.
It's fine.
Do you want to say your name the right way?
It's Christina Perez.
There you go. I love it. Perez?
Not bad.
Well, I mean, I did live in Sao Paulo for 2 years, but didn't learn a lot of Spanish. You know, Portuguese is close enough to Spanish that you feel like you know enough to get by.
It's the same. The Portañol, as they call it. I can sort of fake it when I go to Portugal.
I actually ran into somebody from Argentina when I was down in Sao Paulo, and I did not realize that they were speaking Spanish at first, and I thought I had had a stroke. It was close enough that I was like, I should be understanding this. Why can't I understand this person? Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So we are so glad to have you, despite some technical difficulties on my end that made us get to a late start. Okay, Sunny, I did a horrible intro. Do you want to lead us in with your scheduled programming?
Well, we would usually ask to, because I think your journey is very unusual, and you've seen not just both sides of the fence, but maybe a few different angles of that yard, so to speak, to completely destroy my metaphors. If you could just kind of walk us through the basics of how you got to where you are and became an agent and an author.
So very squiggly career path, I suppose, over the last sort of 20 some years. After I completed a PhD in medieval literature, I decided I didn't want to do that full time. And I kind of backed into becoming a journalist out in China in 2007 in the run up to the Beijing Olympics, which was amazing. And I was out in Asia for nearly a decade in Beijing and Hong Kong and Singapore, teaching at the university in Hong Kong and in Singapore as well. And during that time, I put out an academic monograph based on my PhD. So I guess that was my first kind of foray into traditional publishing, book length form. Obviously, I was working for, you know, Wall Street Journal and CNN, Condé Nast Traveler, doing all kinds of mostly travel and art featured pieces on China and the region. So I'm also familiar with that side of publishing and what those kind of contracts look like. And as a freelancer, which I was most of the time, I was essentially my own agent. You know, a lot of the same skills are involved, where you're producing the content, you're pitching the content, you are like creating those agent relationships, you're negotiating the contracts, and you know, and then you are chasing people for money, which I still do all the time. So actually there's a lot in common between being a freelance journalist and being an agent. You're essentially kind of running a small business. And I tell my authors always to think of themselves in the same way and as a small business, because they are. And so that was kind of how I got my start, I suppose you could say. And then I started playing with fiction a bit, and I sold my first book, which was a young adult novel, although it was not the first one that came out because of publishing and its hijinks, back in sort of 2015. And then I sold a few more young adult novels and ended up moving back to the UK for my husband's job, and suddenly found myself a full-time author, not on purpose, and did that for a few years before realizing that I don't really like being a full-time author. I still like writing a lot, but I really missed running things, having a business. And so I decided to sort of take everything that I had learned creatively from being the author side of the business process and try and get into agenting. So I joined an agency here in London called Zeno Agency that specializes in SFF, and that had been primarily what I've been doing at that time. So it made sense. It was a really good fit, and I started there. And after about, I guess, sort of 3.5-4 years, I decided to just set up my own shop. And actually, it's funny, it's auspicious timing today when we're recording, because it's exactly a year anniversary.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow, I did not realize that it had only been a year for you with your own agency, and that is amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very exciting. A good celebration today, tonight, I'm sure.
Yeah. How would you say your stress level is as an agent compared to as an author? I've just always been curious about that.
People stress about different things, because as an author, I'm all too familiar with the feeling of not having any control over things that are extremely important to me. But as an agent, you don't have nearly as much control as perhaps people think you do, or authors would like you to, or that I would like to sometimes. But you do have to be responsible for authors' careers, or at least giving them the advice. And obviously they make their decisions, but you know, certainly I feel a huge duty of care towards all of my clients who are trusting me to give them the best advice that I can in a given situation. So I think you stress differently, I guess you could say.
I mean, yes, agents are almost certainly a lot busier. Now, can I go, Sonia, if you have something butt in for sure, but you, Christina, you said that you tell your authors to treat their career as a small business. Mm-hmm. Do you have like a primer or an initial few quick tips that you give your authors that you could give to us right now on what that means to treat your career like a business, and how, you know, even existing, established authors, but especially new authors can adopt that mindset?
Sure. I mean, I think what it means is to, diversify your revenue streams, you know, if you can, which is to like write across multiple genres or categories. You know, it is harder to stay published than to get published. And the most likely way to do that, in my experience, is to be able to wear lots of hats. Then there's all kinds of like very practical advice about, I cannot give tax advice, but I suggest that you get an accountant, you know, that you think about whether you want to be a limited liability company or not. And the pros and cons of that, you know, joining either the Society of Authors here in the UK or the Authors Guild, and availing yourself of all the resources that they have, you know, thinking about like authors' liability insurance, like all kinds of little things that you would do if you were setting up a business are things that I definitely will like recommend to newer authors. Actually, it's funny because I was talking with my assistant Isabel today that we're planning on sort of putting together a little bit of a sort of a debut author's guide, or a sort of welcome to publishing kind of 101 for our clients. And then we're sort of deciding what kind of materials would be useful in that, because it is just, it encompasses so many different kinds of skills. And people who have been freelancers before, it's probably like, you know, telling them what they already know. But if they haven't, then there are a lot of things to consider, like keeping all your receipts so you can claim that back, and like the percentage of your apartment that you use for your work, you can claim on your rent, and you know, all that kind of thing.
You said a few things I'd like to skip back to, if that's okay.
Sure.
So the first one is the most concerning one. You said something about liability insurance, and I have never ever heard anybody talk about liability insurance in terms of, you know, a career as an author. I mean, it makes sense to me, you know, right now in my head, for like a journalist, a freelance journalist. But do you recommend that for even, you know, a fiction author, et cetera? And why? What's that all about?
Well, I mean, I'm a super risk averse person. And so I have author's insurance for myself, for my fictional works. You know, you can get it through the Society of Authors here in the UK. They have a relationship with an insurer, and I'm guessing that they do in the Authors Guild too in the US. I'm just less familiar with it since I'm based here. Yeah, I mean, as a journalist, I would say the premiums would probably be higher because you're more likely to get sued. But, you know, if you are going to think of yourself as a small business, then that is just one thing to consider, as you would get any kind of professional indemnity or employer's liability insurance.
Yeah. Have you had anybody that you represent or anybody that you know even have to take advantage of that as a fiction author?
And I mean, personally, no, but of course you do hear about various kind of more high profile lawsuits that happen to do with plagiarism, whether spurious or not. And sometimes these things are based on fan fiction, and, you know, it's just you can't stop people from suing you if they want to. So, you know, and the US is a more litigious place than the UK. And well, that's just, you know, not to emphasize that, but it's just something to think about.
Yeah, that is really, I mean, it makes a lot of sense now that you're saying it. And you just gave me and everybody else something more to worry about. So thanks for that.
Definitely what my plan was going on.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, I mean, you're absolutely correct. Anybody can sue anybody for anything. And people use that as a tool, you know, intimidation, or to get them to settle, or to get them to cease and desist, whether they're correct or not. And that sucks. That's a really good idea. I am going to look into that. And
I was going to ask, you know, there's a lot of emphasis. We talk a lot about our debut years, and it's become a, you know, something that Scott and I have felt strongly, is that how you launch is a huge stepping stone for the careers. And there's kind of different levels of opinion on that from the different people we talk to. But I'm interested in like kind of the agent perspective, particularly, you know, when you're looking at career planning with an author, do you talk about like the impact that certain deals will have or not have? Are there things that you feel authors can do to help themselves launch well? And just generally, how important or not important you think that first debut launch year is for their career long term, if any of that makes sense?
I think that, like everything in publishing, it depends. And that, you know, obviously some people don't do, their first book doesn't break out or what have you, but they come to prominence with their second or third act. Publishing is a marathon and not a sprint. Getting a huge deal right off the bat comes with like tremendous pros and cons. And, you know, it's hard to, you know, turn down a life-changing amount of money because you might not get that again. And so is that the right decision to turn it down because you're afraid you won't earn out? Like, not necessarily. It really sort of depends. And I think that I'm sure everybody you've talked to on the podcast has talked about how much the industry has changed, and that making a living as a mid-list author is, you know, sort of rapidly becoming a thing of the past. And so, it, you know, as an agent, of course, that is something that you talk through with your author in terms of like, what are the ramifications of the different offers that you've been given and the different publishers and the different things they're saying that they're going to do for you or not do for you. And it all the paths look different. You know, every single author of mine, their path has been different. I work with a lot of mid-career authors who are often kind of switching gears, maybe changing category or genre because things, you know, didn't go exactly as they had planned the first time around. And I actually really like working with mid-career authors and planning and strategizing and scheming and, you know, trying to sort of turn things around or in a new direction.
Do you think that careers can be recovered? Because this is something I think that's sort of come up a lot recently with some of my author friends. They've gotten to this point where they've had their first debut, they've had their contract, they fulfilled it, they've done, and there's nothing left. And so it feels like starting from scratch again for them, but harder.
Yes, I think that they can. I mean, myself as a YA fantasy author, you know, those books did well, not amazing. I have fans, they get tattoos. That's awesome. But I switched gears and I have my first adult thriller coming out in May. And I'm really excited for it. It's totally different. I'm hoping that maybe it finds a wider audience or some of my audience comes with me. I had a lot of fun writing that project and just, you know, kind of going into my cave during lockdown and just, you know, coming out with it. So we'll see, you know, maybe that will go dramatically differently. Maybe it won't, publishing. But yeah, no, I mean, I've definitely had authors I've taken on whose careers have maybe stalled out a bit and who have, you know, I've gotten, it depends on how you want to measure success, but if you want to measure success in six-figure deals, then I've gotten that for them. So yeah, it can happen.
Okay. So pretend you're on a podcast with somebody who got a small deal and got punted into a black hole and now wants one of those six-figure deals. What do you tell them?
Do you have a high concept hook?
That's a really good answer. Yeah. Yep. That's a really good answer.
I mean, I tease, although not entirely. That will certainly help. You know, Jaws in Space pitches get a lot of attention. And, you know, and that is not just for kind of satirical reasons. It's because people have very limited attention spans and you need to be able to sell a product, and a book is a product, you know, to somebody in what, 10 seconds on TikTok. You know, if you can say my book is Jaws in Space, people will be like, oh, I think I know what that is. You know?
Yep. Yep.
So yes, so that is important. But also switching names, right? Switching categories, switching genres, mm-hmm. all of these things mm-hmm. to like give you that new car smell again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. I love that new car smell. So in that instance, do you feel that authors are essentially resetting and going back out there as a debut in a new genre with a new name, et cetera? Or is there some sort of still, I don't know, street cred, whatever it may be, that comes from having had a series or a book already out in another genre, even if it didn't do all that well?
By street cred, in from whose perspective?
Well, I mean, how do you approach it as an agent, right? So say you're now pitching this new mid-career genre shift book for an author. You're going out to editors. Are you telling them about that author's previous career? Does that feature? Or are you essentially presenting this author as a new author because they're switching genres?
Well, in terms of sort of being like this, you know, this is XYZ person, but they used to write as ABC person. Like, yes, you usually include that in the pitch letter, in the bio, that writing as whatever their other pen name was, they published, I don't know, 5 YA novels or something like that. You know, you're not trying to sort of disguise who they are in this age of Google and social media. That's not really possible anyway. Yeah. And so it's more a matter of saying like, this is their fresh, shiny branding. And, but of course, you know, they have completed these novels in the past. So we know they can complete a novel, like they kind of know, right. Which is often a question, with a debut. And so I think that can be a positive, but to be completely frank, sometimes it can be a negative if you go back to a publisher where they had been before. I have definitely had, you know, a bad sales track, even in a different category, impact decision-making. And that's just true. So, you know, in that case, you have to sort of rejig your thinking about that particular publisher or that particular imprint.
How are we feeling about platform these days? Because I feel like TradPub has gone through sort of, it went through this phase, it felt like, where everyone was wanting to know that you had TikTok and Twitter. And then I think it felt like from the author side that publishers suddenly realized that wasn't actually very useful and they went back to not really caring. But I just wondered if you'd seen one way or the other from editors.
I think that it depends on what, you know, what category you're writing in, whether it's important or not. I mean, obviously nonfiction is all about platform. You know, even if you're a super expert academic in your field, you know, they want you to also probably be, you know, like a media don, or that, you know, you have a podcast or a Substack or something that shows that you can like engage the general public on your topic and not just other academics. So I say that nonfiction publishing is a different kettle of fish, where that is important for reasonable reasons, you know, where when a nonfiction editor, which, because I also rep nonfiction, is pitching a book, you know, they know more accurately who the reader for that book is going to be, because it's not just, you know, who likes fairies in space. It's, you know, like who is looking for a book that's going to help me figure out the answer to this problem. So, you know, for those reasons, I can understand why platform is important, although it can also sometimes be frustrating. And, you know, and then the fiction, I think that, you know, right now, obviously, there's a lot of emphasis on book talk titles and new adult and romantasy. And there, obviously, kind of having engagement with the readers is really important. I mean, it's a whole kind of part of the kit and caboodle of what fans are looking for from that experience. And so I would say that, yes, in those areas, people will sometimes ask, you know, well, are they very active in their community? Do they have fans online? That kind of thing. I've never been asked that when it comes to crime and thriller, for example. So I think it really varies.
Do you think that romantasy is something that's here to stay? I mean, this is probably something I'll talk to a romantasy author a bit more about in depth, but obviously the it's escalating a lot in our genre. It is sort of the topic of the moment in a way.
Yeah, I do, actually. I think it will shift. You know, I don't think it will be the exact same kinds of romanticism that are popular right now. They're going to be popular, you know, next year or the year after. But I think that it's, I mean, I'm a romance reader, like historical category romance is one of my favorite for pleasure reading categories. And I'm obviously like a huge fantasy fan. And I think it's a natural intersection, really, of two different genres that have a lot of readers in common already, and that both have very loyal readerships. And, you know, fantasy fans will read everything by an author if they like them, and so will romance readers. And so I think it actually makes sense. And so, I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. But I think there will be different sub-genres of that sub-genre that will emerge.
I'm watching Scott take notes on
that. Well, I have to, or the only thing I'll remember when it comes time to ask another question is that she used the phrase kettle of fish, and I've never heard that phrase before. So
maybe it's a UK phrase.
I'm so far in the mid-Atlantic now, because I moved over to the UK in 1998, that I don't even know what is American and what is British in my language at this point.
I have to say things like, do you have phrases like swings and roundabouts? And they're like, what the fuck?
It's like, what's a roundabout? Yeah.
We've now come to the portion of the show where Scott guesses where our guest is from. I was going to say, you talked about having lived in Asia. You know, on your bio, you're very clear about being half Norwegian, half Argentinian. And you clearly have the ability to at least pronounce Spanish things, but you sound like a straight up American, despite the fact that you live in the UK. So yeah, you.
Okay. You want to guess the state?
Connecticut.
Ooh, ouch. No, New York City, okay. Baby.
I mean, that is so goddamn close. Like the fact that.
Not to a city kid. No offense to anyone from Connecticut listening right now, but as a born and bred Manhattanite, no.
not to invoke the cursed name of Joe Rogan that most of our listeners undoubtedly hate, but I have seen a clip from him where he just absolutely shits on Connecticut as being, or maybe it's Rhode Island, but in my mind, they're about the same because I'm not from that area. as being the place where everybody drives through and there's just nothing there. People drive from Boston to New York and that's all that part of the country.
No, to be fair, Connecticut is very beautiful and we love the fall foliage.
I just want some credit for getting like within 100 miles of where you're from.
That's not bad. That's not bad. Fair dues.
That is my favorite segment of the show when it comes up. Sometimes I'm too afraid to try, but sometimes it's okay. So, real questions. So, we talked about, you know, romanticize the new big trend, and retellings, God help us, was the big thing before that. And who knows what the next thing will be.
Dragon Riders.
So, yeah, Dragon Riders. I am so pissed that I didn't get in on the Dragon Rider trend, because I grew up watching this Disney animated film that very few people know of, called The Flight of Dragons. That's like this bastardized version of a book called The Flight of Dragons, but also another book called The Dragon and the George. Anyway, you know, when my parents were too busy with their jobs and life to watch me or whatever when I was a kid, that's what they did, is just played that movie. So I probably have watched it like 1,000 times as a young child. Anyway, getting to the actual questions and not just insane rambling, do you think there is any sort of like a trick, because this is your business, right? Is there a trick for anticipating upcoming trends, and or how hard is it to get a big deal outside of the current trend, right? Because everybody's chasing and throwing big money at romanticy, but not everybody wants to write romanticy. Not everybody's capable of writing romanticy. So what do you do if you still want to have a successful career, but you don't quite fit in the current trend?
Well, I mean, I would say that it's usually like a fool's errand to try and write to a trend, because once you've heard of the trend, like you're too late. So, you know, I think that sometimes you just get lucky that you happen to be writing something that sort of vaguely fits in next to something that has just done really well. And, you know, and then sometimes the stars can align and the magic can happen. But, you know, we see publishers do this time and time again, where they sort of pile in on something that's been successful until it's so saturated and the mm-hmm. things you're publishing are so derivative that nobody wants to see them anymore, you know, or at least the editors don't want to see them anymore. Because I think that editors tend to go off of things a couple of years before the public, because the editors have been seeing them a couple of years before the public. Yeah. And so that, you know, that's a cycle. It's usually like a 7 to 10 year cycle. Now people are asking me for vampires all the time again, right? And you know, you couldn't swing which I'm totally excited about, because actually back when I was an academic, I taught like a whole course on vampires in Western literature. So I'm very pro this turnaround. But you know, it's been, you know, about sort of 10 years since you could really talk about vampires seriously, right? Without somebody wanting to throw you out the window. So you know, that's sort of publishing's downfall a little bit in terms of the way it cycles through things. I basically don't tell authors to really write to any particular thing, especially if it's not their jam, you know, because they're not going to do it as well as somebody who really loves it, you know. Yeah. And for whatever, you know, as they say in the romance community, don't like, you know, yuck somebody else's yum. Like, even if something is not your bag, like there are tons of people who love it and who are going to write it really well. And the readers are going to respond to that, because they're going to realize that like the person writing it is sort of in there with them. You know, like you don't want to sort of come along and try and write an ironic romanticy. I don't know. Because it's not going to be it's not going to be popular with people who love it.
But I always figure, I mean, I'm not into romance at all. I think in today's lingo, I'd probably be classed as arrow or something. So I don't read books that have a strong romance element most of the time, unless it's something like Girls No Reflection, where there's lots of weird, trippy, multi-universe stuff going on in there, which is kind of itch my jam. But I always think, well, you know, I don't read it. There must be other people who don't. And I think there's this thing. It's like, yeah, the romantic market's huge, but like a small market in trad is still tens of thousands of people. Like that's a relatively small market, and that's plenty for one author. And if you could find a small market, it can still sustain you career-wise.
I mean, in theory, I think it's just a matter of actually like the discoverability and how are your readers going to find you? And I think that did used to be easier in the past, but then perhaps people who've been in the industry longer than me will say that it wasn't. Although you listen to publicists and, you know, there used to be a million more media outlets. I mean, I was on the other side of it being pitched, 15 years ago. And I used to be the other side of getting a million press releases. And I still get a million press releases because you never get off those lists. But, you know, it's really interesting to know, like, what the new cool thing is opening in Hong Kong every day. So I get that in my inbox. Yeah, no, I mean, the problem is just that, like, you know, the media landscape has drastically changed. And so the outlets that you can pitch books to has drastically changed. The, you know, the LA Times, what had just sort of got rid of their books editor a month or so ago. And so there are fewer column inches reporting on books. And I think that's one of the big problems in how people find things, which is why it has shifted onto social media as much as it has. And you have much less control of that. I mean, the algorithm controls that.
Yes, like the Guardian and the Daily Mail in the UK, which, you know, I had such mixed feelings when Harper, like, oh, the Daily Mail are going to review your book. And I was like, do they have to, though? Like,
yeah, you do have some women's magazines here, like Red and Grazia, that still have, but very few magazines still have books sections. When I was a teenage girl, I mean, we had Jane and Seventeen and YM, and I'm really dating myself here, but, you know.
Scholastic Book Fairs.
It's a huge thing. It's here too, actually. Okay. Like it's a big portion of the revenue for the whole company. But yes, so there, I would have found out probably about Romantasy in the back of YM magazine in 1994. Yeah, I think that's part of the problem. There's so many things that are been rapidly changing, and publishing is doing its best to keep up. It's just not always succeeding, or not always succeeding as quickly as we would like it to. But, you know, nobody's in publishing for the money, not really. You know, every single person that I know, like, works really hard. The publicists are completely overworked. The marketers are completely overworked. So I do have a lot of sympathy, and perhaps with my vantage point as an agent, where I'm dealing with multiple marketers and publicists on a daily basis for all of my clients, and not just the one person that has been assigned to me, you know, you understand how much stress they're under, and why burnout is so high.
Are there things that authors can do to, I don't even know if this is the appropriate question, to, I guess, alleviate that stress for those industry staff, to help themselves and to help the staff working with them, if that makes sense?
Well, you know, again, it very much depends on the setup at your publisher. But, you know, usually there should be, you know, some kind of publicity or marketing plan, maybe about 3 months out, perhaps 6 months if you're like a really lead title. But those things are getting closer and closer to publication, in my experience. And, you know, having kind of questions, but also suggestions of, you know, if you can come into your publicity and marketing meeting and, you know, saying like, here are like the 10 podcasts that I think are most relevant to my book, or, you know, here are like the 10 bloggers that I think are most, you know, relevant to my book, and presenting them with things that are constructive and additional and helpful, understanding that they're probably not going to be able to do all of them, or even if they do pitch all of them, you know, with their most earnest effort, it doesn't mean any of them are going to come through, you know? Oh, we lost Scott.
Yeah, I think he'll come back in a sec, hopefully.
You know, I think that, you know, to be part of the solution, I think, is probably the best way to approach those discussions, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. And I want to ask a question that's really specific, if I can. And it's
sure.
it's one that I asked our bookseller guest / author guest last week, two weeks ago. And I actually felt bad about it, because I asked him what good pre-sales or pre-orders look like for a book. And he answered it, but we didn't really explain it that much. And I think we started a bit of a panic among the debut authors who listened to this podcast, because they were all going, oh no, my pre-orders and pre-sales don't look like that. So firstly, I was going to say that when we were talking about pre-orders, we were talking about customer pre-orders as well as corporate book sale pre-sales. And we just lumped them together because they tend to be lumped together. But I thought I'd try again with that question and ask if you happen to know, kind of for sci-fi and fantasy, what either what good pre-sales or good pre-orders look like for debuts, or just for any book launching in general, or if that's too difficult.
I mean, you're going to hate me, but I'm going to say again, it depends. You know, yeah. It depends on what the expectations are. It depends on what the level of the advance was and how much money the publisher is on the hook for. I think that this is a reason why here in the UK, subscription boxes have become so important, because they are a firm sale. You know, they are not a sale or return sale. And that is huge. And that can get you on the Sunday Times bestseller list here, because the volume is so much lower than you would need to get on a list in the US, where subscription boxes do not dominate so much. And I would argue that those things are probably related, you know, and obviously getting on that list means that somebody sees that on Sunday, they're more likely to buy it just over the, you know, sale, yeah, point of sale in Waterstones. So, you know, It really depends. I mean, I think the rule of thumb for a very long time now has been that like an average kind of hardback fantasy title will sell like 2,000 hardcovers in its lifetime. You know, that in the UK anyway. I mean, that's a very kind of average one, which is why publishers, you know, have always relied on fantasy to have a long tail, and that has been built in to the usual advances, which have been at the lower side of things compared to, say, like commercial fiction, because, you know, they usually grow things over time. Now, all of that logic is in the process of shifting a bit, but I don't know that we have actually settled upon a new model. So I think a lot of those thinking, you know, that kind of thinking pattern goes into decision making still. If that makes sense. And I am broadly speculating here, and other people in the publishing industry who know more than me are very welcome to contradict me and you know, educate me better. But I think that is something that you will see. And then obviously, you know, in terms of series, like there is the rule of thumb, which is borne out in some statistical analysis that my husband, who is the finance director of my agency, his PhD is in quantum physics. And so he has done some analysis on Nielsen data, and like it does bear out that the trilogy fatigue, you know, is real, that the second book in a trilogy sells half as much as the first book, and the third book sells half again as much, and that actually doesn't really change. You know, we have looked at, there'll be like a little peak maybe first when like a TV or a movie comes out, but then it will drop back down, and the first book always sells better, and the publishers count on that. So when you see, you know, a huge deal go for like a romanticy that's been big on TikTok, and only the first book has been big on TikTok, and you see that they bought three or four books, it's because in a lot of ways, the rest of that series is just marketing for the first book that they know people are going to continue to buy.
Something we've talked about on and off is, for me and Scott, my relief at doing a three books standalone contract, and I think his possible regrets at being locked into a series, because if that first book doesn't sell, then you and your publisher are just chained to those diminishing sales, and that's demoralizing. Do you feel like there are more standalones now? Because I feel like that's something I'm seeing more of, more people on standalone contracts.
I think that there was a lot of trilogy fatigue that sort of like I sold my YA fantasy trilogy in 2016. It came out in 18, 19, 20, and the imprint was folded about a month after the third one came out. And definitely by the time of sort of 2018, 19, people were already saying like, hey, we bought a lot of these trilogies. A lot of them aren't selling that great. Give us a duology, or give us a standalone, you know, give us companion books. Now publishers feel different kinds of ways about companion books. Some publishers like them. Some publishers feel that unless you have a really big audience already in that world, that people aren't going to pick it up, that they prefer to get invested in one set of characters or one relationship to ship. So again, there's just different feeling. I don't know that it's based on hard evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I think my personal feeling here is if you are an established author with a following, it's maybe less of a risk to sign on for a duology or a trilogy, et cetera. Because you have some track record, you have some reason to believe there's going to be read through and some initial buy-in, et cetera. Now, that doesn't always happen. There are plenty of examples of authors who had a successful first series and then drop off real hard. But my personal advice to new authors would be to stay as far away from locking yourself into a long series, even a trilogy, as possible. I think Sun Yi's deal, where she has a deal for 3 standalones and then has a lot of optionality after that, right, makes a ton of sense. And that is absolutely the direction I would go, because as much as I love my trilogy, and I just turned in edits for book 2, had a blast with edits on that book with my new editor. It was just awesome. Like, it's really hard to get excited about writing book 3 when I'm pretty sure book 2 is going to be somewhat dead on arrival, right? And maybe not dead on arrival because, you know, you said 2,000 books is average, 2,000 hardcovers is average for a fantasy novel. And it's always nice to find out you're above average. But, you know, it's all about personal expectations. And if it hasn't necessarily met your personal expectations with the first book, you have very little chance of doing so with the second and third book in a series. So, yeah, my personal advice, or at least what I'm going to go for, is shoot for contracts with multiple books, but either to be determined or, you know, working ideas, et cetera, standalones as much as possible, even if those standalones have potential for future series.
Standalone with series potential is definitely a good way to go. It sort of depends on whether, you know, what the story is you want to tell. If it's something that really, really requires 2 books and it's just not going to make sense if you stop after 100,000 words, then you might want to do a duology. I think a lot of trilogies fall down because they didn't need to be trilogies.
Yeah.
You know, that is sometimes the case, and that can sometimes be why readers drop off. But on the other hand, it can also just be people get, you know, I'm sure you have also seen on social media people saying like, well, I'm not going to buy the series until all 3 have come out so I can binge read them. And it's like, yeah, that's not great. But yeah.
You are the problem, people.
That's part of what our culture, our sort of fast food culture now, is sort of wants to be able to binge it all at once, Netflix style. And that just doesn't work for traditional publishing.
Some ways for me, the emphasis on standalone series potential means you start getting like these fantasy books where the first book in the series is like so complete that I actually don't have desire to read the others. And I think my iconic book for that is The Traitor Baru Cormorant, which is a book that I absolutely fucking love. But I've never read the others in the series because I read it and I thought, this is perfect. I'm just going to stop. And I'm really sorry, Seth Dickinson, if you're out there. But I think because it wasn't, you know, it was written essentially as a standalone, like I think that's how it was conceived. And I know he got a series deal and there's other books, but it didn't feel like the, you know, Wheel of Time book where it's very, he just basically picks a place to stop, doesn't he? And the next one continues on.
I mean, it's something that, you know, the mystery genre and the romance genre has done really well for a long time, which is having these, you know, very long running series, but that you can pick each one up and it's a complete either, you know, happily ever after for one couple, or mystery of the week for, you know, a cozy mystery, or, you know, paranormal romance back in the day, which is now starting to make a comeback with the sort of Sookie Stackhouse and Anita Blake, where it was both. It was like Sexy Times and it was a murder mystery. And you could just pick up any of them out of order. And sure, you would get a bit more out of it if you knew the world and you knew the characters, but you could just read one out of order. And I think that is something that people are now coming to in fantasy and in YA, that the other genre categories have had a lock on for a while.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I'm a huge fan of series, right? Both reading and writing them. Your points are well taken that if you do the first book too well, you wrap it up too well, nobody really has any reason to continue on to the others. I think it's just tricky to avoid that situation where you are contractually obligated to continue a series that isn't commercially viable. And you know it's not commercially viable probably from the first book, because as much as people like to talk about, oh, well, you know, this book or this series picked up really after the second or third book, that represents like 5 years in publishing time. And like that is not a good way to piece together a career, right? Is to gamble on, no. Maybe in 5 years, I'll have some sales, right?
No, I mean, I think that's why you can do multiple things at once. If you have the time or the inclination to try to be, you know, writing in adult at the same time as maybe you're writing in YA or middle grade, because then you don't usually run into so many problems with the non-competes and, you know, just thinking all of that through. Like, I haven't yet had a publisher be like, no, absolutely not. Like, and anyway, these clauses usually say like with written permission. So it's also a matter of being open and honest with your publishers who are your business partners, right?
Yeah.
And it's not like you're trying to go behind their back in a, you know, the depth of night or something. You know, if you say like, hey, you know, I really want to write this middle grade project, and you know, I know that we have this non-compete that says this, but like, I don't think it's going to compete, and you know, usually you can work something out. So I would say don't freak out if the language in your contract seems like maybe more stringent than absolutely would prefer, because usually, and again, I am not giving legal advice here, but usually things can be worked out. It is about the spirit and not always the letter, you know. Obviously, if you have any concerns, go to your agent first.
Yes.
Listen to me on a podcast if you have specific concerns. Generally, I think that people in the publishing industry do work very collegially together.
Whatever word that is, we know.
I'm just like, it's late on the five. It's like 6 o'clock on a Friday. So I'm just like, I think it is collegially.
A lot of words I've only read and not said out loud either.
Same.
So do not use me as your yardstick for sure, or whatever unit of measurement you use in the UK. Meter? Do you have meter sticks over there?
No, it's confused over here. We're not fully continental. We're not fully.
Look, I am an engineer and had to deal with units so many times, and I still don't understand where yard came from, why yard exists. So yeah, I'm not the resource. I also wanted to comment, by the way, congratulations for having a quantum physics PhD doing your finances, that poor man.
Yes. Well, he loves it, actually. He does. No, he crunches the royalty statements, and actually something that we do that's like a little bit unique is that like we present like an annual kind of report to our authors to go over their earnings so that they kind of understand, you know, what the royalty statements mean and where they're at. Again, it's that whole kind of thinking of yourself as a small business kind of attitude. That is something I think is really important. And a lot of times authors don't understand how to read royalty statements because they're Byzantine.
Yeah.
And no, they're horrendous.
They don't make sense. And that is something that you absolutely should understand. And you can ask your agent questions, even if you think that they're like stupid questions. They're probably not, you know? And the other thing is that the publishers make mistakes on royalties all of the time. So if you think something doesn't look right, you should definitely ask. You know, see something, say something, see it, say it, sorted, as they say here on the tube.
The one thing I in particular should probably make clear that you hit on is I completely agree with you that the people in the industry are generally well-meaning, hardworking, overworked, underpaid, and are fantastic. And the issues that we talk about a lot on this podcast are typically systemic, right? And that includes overly prohibitive non-competes and right of first refusal, et cetera, that are giving people fits and that are causing people to, at the very least, you know, delay their plans to diversify their careers, et cetera. So yeah, when we bring things up, especially negative things, typically those things are systemic. And I'm glad that you had a good answer for how to maybe negotiate that and that your answer was to negotiate that, right? And just be upfront with publishers and go to your agent, have them talk through it with your publisher if you're worried about anything that might be keeping you from doing what you want. The other point I wanted to make, and you said that people aren't in this industry for the money, and that is true of the people that matter and that we deal with, unfortunately. But the publishing industry is full of a lot of very large companies that operate at more or less a 10% profit margin. And I believe that 10% profit margin is quoted after tax and everything. Yes, we love publishing people, and they are underpaid and overworked. However, revolution still needs to happen systemically.
I mean, yes, I was talking about humans, not yep, the corporations.
Yep. So we've added in a new segment to our podcast for the season where we ask guests, what is the smallest hill you're willing to die on? Bit in a second. But so like the one we had last week with Jeremy is he was saying that, you know, he thinks that Kelvin is like the one true temperature measurement, and he explained this divine truth to us. So it can be anything like that. No pressure.
Like a non publishing related hill.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Anything you want, wide open.
Oh man. Gosh, that's like, I have way too many. I'm very petty sometimes.
Same.
That's even better.
Yeah, I'm very, I think that there's no amount of coffee that's too much to drink. I'll die on that hill. Yeah. My assistant like looks at me agog as I make my sort of like eighth cup of coffee at the Nespresso with double. Yeah. I like doctors basically give me like the side eye when I tell them how much caffeine I drink every day. So that's my hill. Caffeine.
It's linked to longevity.
The amount that I drink is probably not linked to longevity.
Yeah, I think it's like above two cups. I'm not sure there was an upper limit in the study that I saw, but that might be because they didn't feel like they had to establish that for most people.
Yeah, it's you know, if I have a headache and I have a shot of espresso, it usually fixes it. So I know I have a problem, but I'm okay with that.
I'm probably on about close to a liter a day. It's really bad. It's my one vice other than drinking and never mind, actually.
Should we list your vices and determine whether it's more than one?
my other toxic trait is pretending I only have one toxic trait. So
yeah.
Oh, if you want a chance to plug yourself or tell authors, you know, tell people about your books that are coming out, or authors what kind of things you're looking for, or both of those things, that's very welcome.
The agency is Paras Literary and Entertainment. We're based in the UK, but we have clients all around the world. So I have not been open to queries for a little while, but I may be open to queries again by the time this airs. And that's just because I have such a big client list now that I want to make sure everybody gets well taken care of and is sort of in the production line before I take on anyone new. But, you know, I love a little bit of everything from, you know, I'd say like smart romanticy with good world building. I am a bit of a stickler on world building, to nonfiction, investigative journalism, because I used to be a journalist. Really, really almost anything except for hard sci-fi. The one thing I don't do is hard sci-fi. And I still get sent lots of hard sci-fi by petroleum engineers, but I don't do it. They'll probably now be sending me mean emails, but I have nothing against petroleum engineers. They just genuinely seem to write a lot of hard sci-fi. And then my own book, which is my adult thriller, sort of book club thriller. My pitch for it is sort of Gone Girl meets Big Little Lies in Hong Kong. That is a bit of a Romana Clef of my years out in Hong Kong as a journalist, and it's a satire of the expat scene. There's an heiress that goes off the side of a junk during a luxury gala, but nobody seems to have seen a thing, and that is called The Many Lies of Veronica Hawkins. It'll be out in the UK in May and the US in September. So if you like some rich people behaving badly and post-colonial critique, you might like that book.
That sounds awesome.
It does. And any books in Hong Kong sound good to me as well.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me.
No worries. Thank you so much for your patience with I'm honestly, on like a scale of like 1 to 10, today is 9 for chaos for me. So
no, don't worry.
Thank you both.
It's fine. And thank you for getting up so early, Scott, to chat.
Oh, it's not really that early. It's only early because we're up all night with a 9-month-old who doesn't like to sleep in regular intervals. So
oh wow, congratulations. That's That's exciting.
He's so awesome. God, I love him to death, but holy shit. Having a second one is, yep.
Well, you knew what you were getting into, I guess you could say.
Yep, we did. We did.
You've been listening to the Publishing Radio Podcast with Sunny Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.